Good morning, early birds. You've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Today we have stories about Montana State University Billings, Governor Bullock, and Flathead Lake. We have extra stories for you today, ending this episode of The Worm with an interview from former communications director for Hillary Clinton, Jennifer Palmieri, and an interview with the parents of Jeremy Bullock, the namesake of the Safe School Summit in Butte. It's Friday, August 23rd. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. The Blackfeet Nation hopes to grow its Head Start programs on the reservation. As Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton reports, programs for younger children, language, and culture are in high demand.
The Blackfeet Nation recently received the $4 million of federal grant funding it needs each year just to serve the roughly 400 kids in Head Start on the reservation. But that money isn't enough to serve everyone in need of the program's services. Minetta Armstrong oversees the Blackfeet Early Childhood Center, which houses Head Start.
We cover educational, we cover social services, we cover disabilities. We cover nutrition.
She says the early Head Start program, which serves children ages 0 to 3, always has a waiting list.
We work with the low-income families, homeless, single parents, disabilities. They're the majority that comes in first.
Armstrong says the tribe has applied for several competitive grants to expand that piece of the program and its language and cultural components. That includes trainings for parents so they can continue that education at home. She says they will find out whether that funding will come through later this year. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio.
Montana State University Billings is hoping that a long list of campus upgrades, new student and faculty scholarships, and new leadership will help push the university towards its enrollment goals. Nikki Ouellette reports.
Chancellor Dan Edelman, who joined the university last year, says despite enrollment declines over the past decade,
have no doubt we're set for success. We've made a lot of changes. We've still got more changes to make.
MSUB hopes to grow its student population to 6,000 in the next 5 years. Enrollment across the university's five colleges was 4,300 last fall. Vice Chancellor for Administration and Finance, Susan Simmers, another recent hire, says facility upgrades will attract new and keep current students. These include networked printers and copiers, a streamlined textbook ordering system, resurfaced parking lots, and...
The LA building has Wi-Fi. I understand this is the project that... I understand this has been in the works for a while, so I'm very happy to announce that this is completed.
Many of the 100-plus faculty and staff attending the annual Fall Campus Update on Thursday were also eager to hear about progress on the Yellowstone Science and Allied Health Building, a $15 million expansion and renovation project set to begin construction later this year. Edelman said a contract has been awarded but couldn't share more details. Recruiters are also keen to increase MSUB's military-affiliated and Native American student populations. Dawn Githens, hired last year to direct the Military and Veterans Service Center, says her office partners with the Montana VA, Veterans Upward Bound, the university's Disability Support Services, and others.
We have so many things that other colleges don't have. I really do want students to see us as the destination of choice for military-affiliated students.
This year, MSUB will offer $1,000 Montana Access Scholarships to 200 students. Another $160,000 has been earmarked for faculty professional development and research. MSUB will host a university forum on its strategic planning process on September 23rd. In Billings, I'm Nikki Ouellette for Yellowstone Public Radio News.
Steve Bullock is now the only governor remaining in the crowded field of Democratic presidential candidates, and it's unclear if he'll make it on to the next primary debate stage. Montana Public Radio's Corin Cates Carney reports.
The path is steepening to the Democratic Party nomination, as candidates must poll at 2% and have at least 130,000 unique donors from at least 20 states in order to qualify for the next debate in September. Bullock has yet to reach that threshold and has until next Wednesday to do so. In a campaign press release, Bullock's campaign described the DNC debate rules as arbitrary and said they, quote, have forced out of the race executives with real governing experience, unquote. Bullock criticized the rules on MSNBC Wednesday evening.
Maybe we ought to think about also, like, are these DNC rules for the debates disadvantaging folks that actually have to get things done?
With Washington Governor Jay Inslee ending his climate change-focused presidential campaign Wednesday, Bullock is the last standing state executive in the race. Inslee is turning to run for a third term in Washington State, and former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, who dropped out of the primary earlier this month, has moved to a U.S. Senate race. Bullock has said he's ruled out a U.S. Senate race against incumbent Republican Steve Daines, despite encouragement from members of his own party. If Bullock is unsuccessful breaking through the noise of the crowded primary, it's unclear how he may pivot to other ambitions. However, Montana State University political science professor Eric Riley says running for the presidency can be a springboard.
Oftentimes you'll run for name recognition, you'll run for opportunities in the future. Sometimes people can take a presidential run and that will turn itself into a cabinet position with whomever does get elected. And so there are other opportunities here.
Riley says he can't speculate about what Bullock's backup plan is if the presidential campaign doesn't work out, adding that in politics you don't often see people take gap years. Bullock is continuing to deliver a moderate campaign message in Iowa, where this week he made his ninth trip since launching his presidential bid. Bullock is scheduled to appear this Sunday on a CNN town hall broadcast live from New York. I'm Corton Cates Carney, Montana Public Radio.
There was something odd bubbling beneath the surface of Flathead Lake earlier this summer. It wasn't a lake monster. It was a submarine. Two, in fact. The sub's pilots were there to help cash-strapped researchers physically see the most unexplored depths of Flathead Lake for the unforgettable price of free. Montana Public Radio's Aaron Bolton explains.
If you're an aquatic researcher studying deep bodies of water, it can be hard for scuba divers to see what's at the bottom, unless, of course, you're doing a different type of diving, say, in a submarine.
So, Aaron, you're not claustrophobic, are you?
Well, this will be a good test, all right?
That's right. Hank, we have a screamer!
On a recent Tuesday morning, I left the Flathead Lake Biological Research Station's dock to meet Hank Pronk, who lives in nearby British Columbia, to get into his cramped two-man sub.
Okay, that's bang on 40 feet.
That's bang on 40 feet there. You want me to go down? Okay.
All right, we're gonna dive.
Pronk then descends beneath Yellow Bay on the east side of the lake.
So we're 14 feet from the bottom right now. Oh, we're on a slope, I see.
We dive about 40 feet below the surface, but Pronk's sub can dive much deeper, to 1,000 feet, though he's only run safety tests at around 300. The biostation struggles to explore below 100 feet because its research divers can't go that deep without specialized experience and equipment. Research scientist Jim Kraft with the University of Montana's biostation says they've only conducted limited deep water research in Flathead Lake, which is 380 feet at its deepest point. A big reason is because the equipment required to reach the lake's bottom is so expensive. Researchers also don't really know a lot about what's down there in the first place.
Unless you're going to do a lot with them, to put out, you know, $20,000 or so for a rover, or, shoot, I don't know how much a submarine costs, but I'm going to probably put it into hundreds of thousands of dollars. We just don't have the research need to justify that kind of an expense.
Even just to hire a commercial sub for a day can cost thousands of dollars. That's why Kraft jumped at the opportunity to work with Interspace Science. It's a website that connects researchers with private submarine owners. Alex Smith is the site's founder.
And it seems to be working out. I mean, we started it 2 years ago.
Smith is among the six submarine and one underwater rover owners currently in the group. They solicit expedition ideas from researchers through the website, and each can decide whether they want to go on the trip. Because they're not commercial operators, no money exchanges hands. They're just in it for the experience.
It's much more rewarding to use your sub that way than to just potter around and you know, just come home with a family video or something. So it's a win-win.
The week of dives on Flathead Lake this month were only the second scientific expedition Interspace Science sub-owners have taken. Last year, two pilots took University of California Davis grad students beneath the surface of Lake Tahoe. Smith hopes the resulting research will spread the word about Interspace Science and bring in more expedition requests, both in Europe and the U.S. The biostation's Jim Kraft says he's not entirely sure what research may come out of the dives in Flathead Lake. For now, the algae and sediment samples researchers asked the sub-pilots to get will sit on the shelf until they can be processed this winter. The results could lead to formal research proposals down the line. They also asked for video of invasive mysis shrimp, which will be analyzed in the near future. That could inform ongoing research on the crustacean's population and profound effects on the ecosystem.
They do a daily migration up to the surface at night to feed and then back to the bottom to evade predators. So understanding their habits and what they're doing is really nice. So we had them do a night dive, and I'm real excited to see that video.
Let's see if we can see any of these little guys.
In that video, you can see thousands of mysis that look like tiny white specks swimming to the surface, something researchers have seen in the lab, but would have never been able to see in the wild if it weren't for a few private sub-owners who wanted to combine their hobby with science. Aaron Bolton, Montana Public Radio News.
The inaugural Jeremy Bullock Safe School Summit held in Butte this week brought around 150 teachers, school administrators, law enforcement, and mental health workers together to talk through the growing concern about violence in schools. The summit is named after Jeremy Bullock, an 11-year-old boy shot and killed on a school playground in Butte 25 years ago. Montana Public Radio's Corin Cates Carney spoke with Jeremy's parents, Robin and Bill Bullock, during the convention this week.
Robin, in your opening comments, you mentioned that after you lost Jeremy, a police officer came to you and said, this is a once-in-a-lifetime tragedy. And then over the last 25 years, you've seen other families lose children in this way. How do you make sense of that?
I don't think there is sense to be made. I think there is a unfortunate growing group of families that have continued to be impacted by these type of incidents. And whether it's a loss of child through an act of violence such as this, or through a loss of child through suicide because they've been bullied or something, it is still an incredible loss to that family, to that community. So I don't make sense of it as a family. In a community, we continue to survive, and we hope, like Jeremy did, to improve the conditions that we currently have, because that's what he would want.
We have to do a better job as parents. It falls upon us to keep our children safe and make sure that they're not harming others, and we have all the help we can ask for from all the state and local agencies, but we have to do it, and we have to take accountability.
This is the first summit on school safety in Jeremy's name. Why was that needed now?
The 25-year mark hit us fairly severely because 2018 was a horrendous year for student safety. And we started talking about that, how can it still be this bad and continuing to get worse?
When Jeremy Bullock was shot in the spring of 1994 by another student at Margaret Leary Elementary, he was reportedly the youngest school shooting victim in the nation's history. According to the reporting collaborative Guns in America, school shootings are rare. However, there are data to support that school shootings are becoming more common. A Federal Center for Disease Control and Prevention report published earlier this year says that between July of 1994 and June of 2016, more than 420 people were killed in school-associated homicides. According to the Center for Homeland Defense and Security, last year was the deadliest year of K-12 school shootings in the United States, based on publicly available data going back to 1970. The center reports 61 people, including shooters, were killed in school shootings in 2018. when people are talking about this issue, school safety, violence in schools, specifically gun violence, how have you seen that change over the last 25 years?
When 25 years ago we went and we worked with the legislature and the juvenile justice system, Montana was one of the first states to start outlawing guns around school properties. We're not anti-guns. There's a place for hunting, particularly in Montana. Our family hunts, but it should not be around schools and certainly not around students or children that can get a hold of them and do something as harmful as what happened here. I wish I could say that things have improved over the years. Some of the statistics, I'm amazed at the unfortunate nature, and it seems that somehow we're losing the ability to actually collaborate with each other, have respectful dialogues and conversations with each other, and actually try to make progress.
Is that frustrating?
It's frustrating. It's unfortunate. It's so saddened that it hasn't improved, but we are heartened by looking at the faces around at the conference and knowing that so many people want to help their students and want to make improvements. That's what we're really trying to focus on, is how can we be hopefully that positive catalyst to try to improve some conditions here.
As Robin and Bill Bullock talk, they occasionally reach for the other's hand.
We got to do what we can, one child at a time, one school at a time. There's no simple answers. It's not just the guns. It's all of the different problems coming to a head.
It's amazing how much influence one individual can have, because frankly, it was only one individual that took our son. And whether it's just providing a kind word to a student in need or a parent in need, it's amazing how those little things that you do on a daily basis can really help people out.
The politics of gun violence, the politics of school safety seems inseparable from this conversation. As a family who is more politically connected than most, with a family member being a governor, a presidential candidate, Steve Bullock, how do you look at how that conversation is happening, people who could change policy?
Well, we just hope and pray that they will use the resources available to them to do the right thing.
We'd hope for common sense and respect.
You use the word or the phrase common sense, and I hear that a lot, and everyone has a different idea behind what that is. But for you, what does that mean when you say there needs to be some common sense? Are there specific things you want to see happen?
We specifically are the side of the family that's not politicians. And to us, common sense is making sure that you have respect for each other, that you are educated in everything that you do, whether it's associated with firearms, whether it's associated with mental health, whether it's associated with a family well-being. Each of these things, there is no one, if you just do this one thing, everything will be magically solved. That's not how this works. Because even if you address one leg of the stool, you still need to address all the other elements as well. We hope that through summits like this, with open dialogues about whether it's mental health or guns or student plans, that we can create a space for continuous improvement. That would be common sense.
The Jeremy Bullock Safe School Summit included sessions on trauma-informed school drills and emergency planning, how to use grants to pay for safety projects, and best practices for student and school safety. With the namesake of the summit being your son Jeremy, what should people know about his story?
He was this incredible son, brother, student, nephew, grandson, who loved school, who would always draw rainbows, loved playing outdoors, loved his family, loved nature. We would always take hikes, and he would always pick up trash along the way because they always believe in leaving a place better than when you entered it. And hopefully he continues to live on doing that through summits like this, through the fields that were built, and through his brothers and sister.
Jeremy was beautiful. There is there isn't a day that we don't grieve his loss. It's sad that the world hasn't been able to enjoy him like we did for such a brief time.
Bill and Robin Bullock, thank you so much for taking the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Corin.
Thanks.
2016 saw the first woman ever to be nominated for president. This election cycle, six women are vying to be the first female elected president. As communication director for Hillary Clinton, Jennifer Palmieri had a front row seat to that failed effort. Palmieri was also communications director for President Obama and has written a best-selling book called Dear Madam President. Palmieri is in Missoula working on another book and sat down with Sally Mock to talk about the 2016 campaign and what it'll take for a woman to win in 2020.
I do want to talk to you a little bit about 2016. And I know you've said that at the time, during the campaign, you didn't think that it would be hard to elect a woman president.
I think it's one of the most important things I can tell people about the experience is that I didn't think it was going to be hard, because I think that then opens them up to hearing more about what I have to say about how hard it was. Because, I mean, I was excited to elect the first woman president, but that was not my, it's not a, you know, it hasn't been a life goal, or I thought we had elected the first black president, and I thought in America that was a very hard thing to do. And I felt like in my own career, I had been, you know, done really well and always felt supported by men and women both. And I just thought, you know, eventually there'll be a woman president. I guess it'll be Hillary. Great. Good for her. And I just, after the experience, I see things very differently.
Well, I want to talk about that, but I want to just point out that your boss didn't think it would be easy.
She did not.
This would be Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton was the least surprised person that of everyone on the campaign that we lost, because, you know, she was Hillary Rodham for a long time, but she'd been like quote unquote Hillary Clinton for about 40 years and understood that she drew a lot of fire and was always kind of a polarizing figure. Going into the campaign, I thought that was about her being in politics for a long time. And if you survive a long time, you're going to have a lot of scar tissue, right? You're going to get attacked. And I thought that's what it was about. And then I came to realize that I think it's about a woman, and in this case, her, almost like always stepping outside of the box that women had normally been in. And I think there's something about that that people find vexing. They don't quite know what to make of her. There's something about it that confounds them. There's something about her I just don't like, right?
Well, here we are 4 years later, Jennifer, and there are all these women running for president now. Will it be easier or harder for them to win because of 2016? That's a question a lot of people speculate about.
I mean, you know, who's really to say, but I think it's probably easier. The thing that I worry about is when I hear things like, oh, well, a woman can't win, and I hear a lot of women saying a woman can't win.
And that 2016 proved that.
That 2016 proved a woman couldn't win. So I heard that a lot at the beginning of the campaign, you know, in January, February. I hear less of it now that you see Elizabeth Warren in particular doing as well as she is. My takeaway from 16 and 18 is, you know, there's been two times that we've had elections when Donald Trump was, you know, factor. And both time, you know, in 16, a woman got more votes, and in 18, women won by historic numbers. So I don't want people to draw the wrong conclusion. But I do think that it's easier, you know, the day that Elizabeth Warren got into the race, Politico did a story about how is she going to deal with her Hillary likability problem. And first, I was discouraged to see that. But then everybody went crazy on Politico. Like, how can you say this? And so now, at least, I think there are still things that, you know, men may have an easier time of, but we're more cognizant of these biases that hurt women, I think.
You've written that women are held to a different standard than men. And one of the examples you wrote about was Amy Klobuchar, who got blasted for how she treats her staff, apparently rudely at times. And you pointed out that a male candidate who treated staff that way would be seen as kind of a tough leader. And a woman
hard charging.
Right. But a woman like Klobuchar who does that is seen as, you know, the B word.
Yeah. Right? I mean, and Sally, if I may say, I think I have a lot of insight in this particular article. So, because I really thought about it. Look, Amy Klobuchar has a reputation of being really hard on staff. And I think that there is some truth to that. And Amy has, she's a friend of mine. She has owned that. She said she like needs to do better. So I don't want to excuse mistreatment of staff. But what I know is that two things. One, you know, it will be written that Rahm Emanuel, you know, was former mayor of Chicago, is tough on his staff. But it's done in a way to describe how colorful and hard charging he is. And, you know, the same, I worked for Bill Clinton.
Known to have a temper.
Known to have a temper. We would refer to it as purple rage when he would just blow up, you know, usually about the press coverage. As staff, we thought it was cool to work for a guy that was hard charging and tough because it showed how tough we were. And usually that man was successful and respected and we wanted to be associated with him. But we think it's humiliating to work for a woman who's hard to work for. Mm-hmm. And that was like a big insight to me about things in our own like staff that our minds have to change.
Well, you've also written that there is overt bias and then there's unconscious bias. And you've talked about how voters will say something like, you know, there's just something about Pete Buttigieg that I just like. And then they'll say about Elizabeth Warren, there's something, I'm not sure what, but I just don't like her. Right. And that's an unconscious bias, right?
Yeah. And it's when we get to those intangibles, when you can't say, you know, I mean, it's fine to say Elizabeth Warren's for Medicare for All, and I think that's a bad solution, right? But it's the, there's something about her I just don't know, or I hear a lot about Beto O'Rourke, who's a very talented politician. I have a lot of respect for him, particularly how he handled the shootings in El Paso. But you hear that about Buttigieg and Beto, right? Like there's just something about him. Or like, I don't find the woman candidates inspiring. They do find Mayor Pete and Beto inspiring. I thought a lot about that. It's because Vanity Fair asked me to write a piece after they put Beto O'Rourke on the cover. Vanity Fair asked me to write a piece about why the women candidates weren't ranking out as much as the male candidates were early in the race. It's like, well, maybe because you put Beto O'Rourke on the cover of Vanity Fair. And so I thought a lot about it. And I think that it's like when Beto, I find Beto inspiring too. And when I see him, I see Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I see Jimmy Stewart on the Senate floor with the floppy hair and the exaggerated hand gestures, all right, the insistent voice. It's a very familiar thing to us. And I hear Pete Buttigieg talking about bullying and how he stands up to bullies. And you like see Atticus Finch. Like these are deep, deep models that we have in our heads about what's inspiring. And the tough thing for women and for candidates of color is that white men have a very easy path to being seen as selfless and inspiring by virtue of the fact that they're so privileged, right? So when Joe Biden,
they can afford to be.
They don't have anything at stake themselves, right? And it's not anything to take away from any of these men because they are inspiring and they are all running for president because they love this country and they want to help it. But when Joe Biden does a video like he did when he announced his presidency about the Charlottesville race riots, and he stands up to fight racism, we find that selfless because he's a very successful white man. He doesn't have anything at stake. But, you know, when Cory Booker talks about that, you're like, oh, well, he's a black man and wants to be president. Or if Amy Klobuchar talks about that, you're like, well, she's trying to get power. She's trying to be the first woman president. She's trying to seize power and he's giving it back. Right. Mm-hmm. This is when I'm like, oh, this stuff is really
So how does a woman candidate for president overcome that? What's your best advice?
I mean, my best advice is win, right? I mean, I did have this awareness late in the campaign in 16. I still thought Hillary was going to win, but I think it was like October. And I thought, oh, I just had this like thunderbolt. I said, what we have done is we have turned her into a female facsimile of the qualities that we look for in a male president.
Don't show emotion.
Yeah, don't show emotion. She's got to prove she can be commander in chief. You know, Trump's going to hurl terrible insults on the debate stage and she's got to
keep your cool.
She can't ever show it. He's lurking behind her and she can't blanch. And you're like, well, no wonder people think she's inauthentic, right? no wonder people are like, I don't really have a good sense of who she actually is. And then at the same time, I thought, but I don't have any other model. And we had to prove that she could be president. So that's proving she can do the job the same way as it's always been done, which is always by a man. And I still thought she was going to win at that point. But I thought, wow, when she's the first woman president, it's going to be a big deal. Like, that's a big responsibility on her to show what this looks like. And I do think that it's very possible a woman can end up as her nominee. It's very possible that a woman can win. But there's not, you know, we're past the sort of checklist mark for women trying to succeed, right? It's like we're in uncharted territory now. And now I think you just have to do it in your own way.
And be authentic.
And be authentic and dress the way you dress. And understand that, and I think that's what's so interesting about the freshman women in Congress now, is that a lot of them do, you know, come from communities that are not wealthy, that are very diverse, and so important that their communities look at them and see somebody who looks just like me is a member of Congress, you know. That's how I think you get real change, and when the government does look like the people it's supposed to represent.
I think you've been informally advising Governor Bullock on
his... Steve Bullock is a good friend of mine, and I think that Montana is really lucky to have... I just find him to be a remarkable leader. I think that if America gets a good look at Steve Bullock, America is going to love him. And I think Iowa's going to love him, and that is a good path for him.
Can you envision a 2016 Trump supporter voting for a Democrat in 2020?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah, and this state taught me that. This state taught me that, and actually another place I spent a lot of time in lately is Mississippi, which just happens to be the state I was born in. And I've met people with Governor Bullock. He'll ask them, well, tell her why you voted for Trump. And a lot of times it's like, you know, I just never felt like somebody was looking out for me. Or we just needed a big change, and I thought maybe he'd just like blow up the system be better, but I don't love it. Like, I don't love all of it. You know, would that person vote for Steve Bullock for president? Yeah, they would. I think it is possible. I also have heard, I just couldn't vote for Hillary. There's something about her I just didn't like. I've heard that a lot here,
right,
too.
Right. One final question. Can you envision someone who was a Bernie supporter in 2016 and still is voting for someone else?
If he's not the nominee, I could see. Yeah, I worry about that. I could see that as a problem. I do. Yeah, I do worry about that.
I have been speaking with Jennifer Palmieri, who was the communications director for Hillary Clinton in 2016 and for President Obama during his tenure. It's great to talk politics with you, Jennifer. Thank you so much.
So fun. Thank you, Sally.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds Monday morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.